Well, good afternoon, everyone. So lovely to see you all at the first CELS lunchtime seminar of the year. My name is Catherine Barnard, and I have a great pleasure to introduce you to Julian Gosch. Now, it's customary in these events to give a very long CV, but can we just say he's marvellous? He is a very distinguished tax silk. He's a part-time judge.
Still judging.
Yeah. And he's also, most importantly, a brilliant supervisor and supervising across a range of subjects here at the university. He's given a lot of thought to this subject because, as a tax specialist, it has particularly bitten in his field. And so, Julian, the floor is yours. Talk for about 25 minutes or so, and then we'll take a few questions.
Sure.
And wrap up sort of about 10 to 5 to 2 so you can get to your next appointment. So, Julian, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm ready. Let's go, because and thank you, Catherine, for your for the introduction. It's true, I have views on retained EU law, and I'm going to give you a series of effectively bullet points. Some people define an expert as somebody who knows what they're talking about and who has slides, no slides. So I'll tell you what the rules are. And then I will tell you what I think about those rules in the sense of critiquing them, and then absolutely over to you. But to fast forward, my big message is this: there are good reasons for a UK university to be teaching EU law, but unless you're a tax lawyer, and I'm choosing my words very carefully, in the sense that retained EU law absolutely has relevance to if you're an employment lawyer, you're an IP lawyer, you're an environmental lawyer, but unless you're a tax lawyer, EU law proper and the retained EU law regime has less and less relevance to day-to-day practice, day-on-day, year-on-year. They throw up the regime, the retained EU law, it's now called assimilated law regime, throws up big public law questions. And I'll mention them. Looking at the retained EU law regime in the 2018 Act, the legal relevance of that is becoming more and more vanishingly small. And I give you, this is my view. You can let me know if you disagree, but I'm going to give you reasons why I say that. Now, we need to start from somewhere. So let's start from exit day, 31st January 2020, and then IP completion day, with EU law still applied, until 31st December 2020. Bear those dates in mind, because, and I can see at least one of my students, EU students here, Ruxi, welcome. As from 31st January 2020, the UK was no longer a member state. That might be stating the obvious, but it means that the loyalty clause in the TEU no longer applies. And I've asked you, if you don't mind, please hold that thought. So, the EU Withdrawal Act 2018, what did it do? Well, it identified what the drafts person, he or she thought, were sources of EU law. One, UK legislation. The jargon was EU-derived domestic legislation. Legislation, primary and secondary. One way or another, enacted for the purpose of the UK fulfilling its EU obligations. Two, and just pausing there, that's not really EU law at all. It's UK law. It's implementing EU law, so what? Actually, and that's true even if you're an employment lawyer, even if you're an IT lawyer. Two, regulations which have direct effect, direct EU legislation. Three, Section 4 rights, what are they? It's the EU law that's a result of the direct effect of the two treaties, a directive, or general principles. Now, there were lots of controversial questions, and there are still controversial questions as to the scope of these different sources of retained EU law. The Section 4 rights, these were rights which were of a kind recognised and available as at 31st December 2020. What does that mean? Recognised by who? There are cases. One is called Harrison Environmental Agency that says, well, you identify the kind of category of EU rights of a kind. It doesn't have to be that particular right identified by the CJEU or a domestic court. You've got to identify the category of rights. Terrifically helpful. But it's clear, for those of you who are interested, it's paragraph 91 of this case, Harris. General principles. Now, whether you're talking about effectiveness, equivalence, equal treatment, abuse of right, to be clear, as from 31st December 2020, they cannot give rise to a cause of action. That's specific. Schedule 1, paragraph 3. So, they're interpretative only. That's what the 2018 Act did. And if you're an EU scholar, it's the Barch notion of a general principle. So it can't apply unless it's tethered to the words of either the treaty or a directive or a regulation. It tells you what those words mean. It can't apply by itself. It is the opposite of the sort of general principle the Court of Justice had in mind in cases like the cases that bookended Barch, Mangold, and Cucurvecchio. These are freestanding principles. That went. Disapplication, gone. Chapter 1, paragraph 3. I'll come back to disapplication. So even the students ought to know by now, inconsistent domestic law with EU law for member states, it is disapplied so far as it tramples on EU rights. Gone. Charter of Fundamental Freedoms. Gone. Now, until 2023, so this is the 2018 Act, right? Until 2023, what we had then are these sources: domestic legislation implementing EU obligations, regulations, Section 4 rights, general principles, but these are interpretative only. But very oddly, as EU law stood at 11 o'clock at night, midnight EU time, on the 31st of December 2020. So if you were teaching EU law to somebody who was trying to apply retained EU law, you should be teaching out of 2020 books, even in 2050. It's silly. But that's the regime. That's because there was two reasons to have this regime, and neither of them were to do with EU law as a beautiful system of law. That's an oasis that we should keep. It's the opposite, is to keep a functioning statute book and to rebrand laws as UK laws, not in the EU anymore. So that, I think, is something lawyers have to deal with. Now, before we get to 2023 and the big changes, what the Supreme Court decided in Lipton was that even for pre-Brexit events, Brexit meaning either pre-exit day events or pre-IP completion day events, it's the 2018 Act and its provisions that govern rights and obligations. Because the competing view, and this was the view of the dissenting judge, my Lord Lloyd Jones, who's a friend of this university, he's a friend of mine. He said, oh, no. For a pre-Brexit event, for something that happened pre-Brexit, surely it's just full EU law. No. And it was a court of five judges. It wasn't sufficiently important that they had seven judges or 11 judges. Just a normal case. And I think that's the right answer. People have taken religious views as to whether this is the right answer or not, and they write long articles saying, well, why the Supreme Court majority got it wrong. I think that ship has sailed. As it happens, if you read the transitional provisions in the 2018 Act, and they're in Schedule 8, paragraph 39, I mean, what else would you look? They actually ask, when did an action begin? They don't ask, when did the event happen? That was a clue. And for those of you who are comparative constitutionalists, my great friend and co-author of a book that you may or may not have come across called Waiting for Scythe, Chris Forsyth came from South Africa, and he's my dear friend. And he and I, when we were looking at this, Chris came up with a great point, which I ran with, which he says, this is just like a previous British colony, which then gets independence, but has kept some statutes. But those statutes are going to be construed differently. And there are cases, it's called local jurisprudence, which run with this idea. Now, I'm not making an analogy of leaving the EU with the British Empire. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying juristically it's the same. He's right. It's constitutionally proper to acknowledge Brexit, legally speaking, as a jurist. So that's the complete court analysis. I don't care when your complaint started. And Lipton, Mr. and Mrs. Lipton, their flight, it's ironic, their flight was in January 2018. If they'd litigated there and then, and by some miracle, the litigation had completed before IP completion date, which is when the 2018 Act came into effect, they would have had full EU law. It's only because the litigation, as it were, crossed the line and it was decided by the Court of Appeal and then the Supreme Court after IP completion date, 2018 Act has effect. You can say it's retrospective if you like. Another point of view is that the Act has effect according to its terms. Now, 2023 comes along. What happens then? But short, this is my big message. EU law proper, unless you're a tax lawyer, it's gone. Why do I say that? One, the Section 4 rights, direct effect of the treaty, directives, abolished, Section 3. Two, general principles, abolished, Section 4. Regulations still apply, supremacy. Now, in the 2018 Act, as originally drafted, Section 5 of the 2018 Act gave supremacy to retained EU law, or rather EU law, over, as it were, existing UK law. But not you might say, of course, to UK laws enacted after IP completion date. That was also constitutionally a bit odd. The UK's left. You don't need the notion of supremacy for a functioning statute book. Anyway, who cares what I think? That's now gone. Charter of Fundamental Rights, there was a frankly daft provision in 2018 when it was when the EU Withdrawal Act was first enacted. Charter of Fundamental Rights gone, but they said, oh, you've got to read cases Court of Justice cases, as if any reference to the fundamental rights was a reference to the analogous general principle. Now, although some of the fundamental rights codify general principles, others don't. So that was all, that was, again, madness. It was a very badly drafted act. I don't care that they didn't have much time. It was a very, very badly drafted act. Anyway, forget all that now, it's gone. So, for anybody other than a tax lawyer, what have you got left? Huh? You've got UK legislation that implements EU obligations, if you're an employment lawyer, if you're an environmental lawyer, consumer protection. If you do tort and you look at product liability, for instance, you could go on. But your task is not anymore after 2023 to ask, do I apply Court of Justice case law? The statute called it retained EU case law. They just meant case law decided before IP completion day. General principles, but they're interpretative only. Your task is to say, I will construe this provision. I will recognize as a totally normal function of purpose of construction that it implemented EU obligations. What difference does that make? That's a legal question. What there is a series of the most extraordinary NDVIII powers from sections 11 to 14, where, put short, government ministers of the Crown, devolved ministers, that's like the Scottish ministers from my own country, they can restate or revoke or amend any, we can call it retained EU law, it's rebadged as assimilated law. That means, one, the UK legislation that implements EU obligations, and two, the regulations, EU regulations that direct EU. Now, wow, that is a huge, 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 huge Henry VIII power. And there will be legal controversies as to the scope, particularly of so-called EU-derived domestic legislation, enacted for the purpose of implementing EU obligations. Take something like the Companies Act. That's never been amended relevantly to comply with EU provisions because it already did. And you could have a frankly boring, sterile, but potentially incredibly important conversation as to whether it is within this category. Now, I met Lionel earlier on. If you're an IP lawyer in the same position. So if you're a student or a scholar today, you're in a world in which you take the UK legislation, you construe it, but that UK legislation, if it falls within the scope of implementing EU obligations, it is subject to these massive NDVIII powers. Jonathan Mans, my Lord Mans, when he read it, he said, no, it doesn't say that. Does read it. You couldn't believe it. Now, I said about tax lawyers. I want to say something about tax law, then I want to close by saying something short about so-called Marleasing and general principles. Tax law is there's one island where EU law still matters because it's taken us back to the pre-2023 world. And for those of you who want to know, there was a statute called the Taxation Cross-Border Act 2018, Section 42. It said in terms that the EU Withdrawal Act 2018 has all sorts of things to say about retained EU law, I paraphrase. Don't worry, and they really mean don't worry the revenue. Abuse of right is their word, relevant. Certainly, it must mean relevant in the context of the 2018 Act, interpretative only. And the reason I say that's important is that abuse of right as a general principle, the revenue routinely runs that as a standalone principle in the mangled sense, in the cucurvecchi sense. I did a case that lasted 10 years that went from the FTT to the UT to the Court of Justice, back to the UT, up to the Court of Appeal. We finally won 10 years later. I was for the taxpayer. Because the revenue ran abuse of right. You set up a company in Jersey to avoid VAT. That was abusive. It didn't say that gives meaning to other phrases like, do you have a connection to the UK? Nothing like that. It's just, that's abusive. Those days ought to have gone. 2023, of course, abolishes all gender principles, bad for the revenue. So FA 24, Finance Act 24, Section 28 says, and I paraphrase, but this is exactly what it does. Still no disapplication, that's express. But all of these Section 4 rights are resurrected, but as they were immediately before the 2023 Act. So for example, gender principles interpretative only and frozen as at 31st December 2020. So that's a little island. It's a modified island. It's a Lipton island. Everything else, Lionel's IP world, Catherine's employment world, consumer protection, you're just a UK lawyer recognizing that the statutes you're grappling with, you're dealing with, have a genesis of EU law. That is one factor. That takes me on to what I want to close with, Marleasing and gender principles. Marleasing, for those students who haven't got there yet, Marleasing fits into a model of remedies. You've hurt me. You've trampled on my EU rights. What are my remedies? Because I'm not going to take a case with the intellectual joy of knowing what my EU rights are. What are my remedies? Answer, sympathetic construction. Courts try to construe potentially offending domestic legislation to be compliant with the treaties, a directive, a regulation, so there is no breach. Failing which, disapplication. Failing which, damages for sufficiently serious breach. Now, the English courts, I do mean English, well, Scots court could have come to the mad decisions the English courts have come to, gave this notion of sympathetic construction a meaning and a technique far beyond construction, far beyond what the European Court of Justice calls construction. There are cases saying you can't construe contra lege, but you have got examples of cases, that's it. And particularly my day job world, tax cases. The law is X, Court of Appeal reads in, but not unless it tramples on EU rights, in which case it's not X, literally not X. Case called IDT. Partial disapplication, the disapply words here and there. Now disapplication's gone. And this notion of Marleasing, the so-called muscular construction, if you read Marleasing itself, comes from the combined effect of supremacy and the loyalty clause. It's both. The explanatory notes that say it comes from just supremacy, that's just wrong. Whoever wrote that, bad. So if you read Marleasing, that's where it comes from. The loyalty clause has gone. And we're so back to purpose of construction. Now, you might say, who cares? I think you should care. So for example, take a boring point like VAT grouping. If companies are in a VAT group, you ignore all the transactions made amongst the companies in the VAT group because we'll treat them as one person. It's a kind of convenient thing to do. But should a VAT group, if you're talking about UK VAT, should a French company or a German company, when the UK was a member state, be included in that VAT group? Now, that answer isn't just, as it were, technical to VAT. That answer will also be informed by competition law and free movement. So it matters a lot that mar leasing should no longer be a thing, but it is. If you look at cases, pretty much any cases, you will find that the judges are sitting there as if Brexit never happened. Now, the problem with that, you could be very pompous and say it brings up rule of law questions, but it undermines the credibility of this regime. It's a silly way for judges to behave. The trouble is, nobody knows these provisions are here. Nobody's teaching them. And it should be taught somewhere, ideally constitutional law. That's where it belongs. It doesn't belong to EU law, this regime. It belongs to constitutional law. But not teaching it is a bad place. And I don't know anywhere, any university where it's taught. Not properly. And I'll close with general principles. If you want an example of a case, it's a case called Allianz and Barclays. It's all to do with competition law, but it was a complaint. For those of you who knew competition law, it's Article 101, 102 of the treaties. And then but it's all to do with, was there a duty to what's called passive investors? Anyway, paragraph 74, the Court of Appeals, and just any court, finds all of us. It says, post-Brexit, their words, the principle of effectiveness did not survive Brexit. And that's correct in this sense, unless you're dealing with, it's not just taxes, VAT, it's not all taxes, VAT. Unless you're dealing with that, it's gone. And in case anybody's wondering about transitional provisions, the abolition of these general principles, abolition of the all notions of supremacy, all that, there is a transitional provision, section 22, little 5 of the 2023 Act, saying this Act doesn't affect anything that happened before the 31st of December, 2023. The problem is, what that takes you back into is the 2018 regime. You can't just apply EU law again. So that's the law. If you're a tax lawyer, EU law still matters up till 31st December 2020. If you're not a tax lawyer, I don't care if 100% of the UK legislation you grapple with came from EU obligations. You're the same as the rest of us now. It's normal purpose of construction. And mar leasing is no longer, insofar as it's different from, call it normal construction, that should no longer be a legitimate technique. So that's a lot. I'm sorry, I've gone over time, but that's a lot from me. Questions, please.
Thank you very much indeed.